Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all those other podcasts that are making their home over there. And check out all the other things that we're doing over there. We've got articles, academies, videos. We've got all kinds of events, all kinds of things for you that you can check out. Just make sure you go over there, peruse the website, and take advantage of all the things that we have to offer. Eric, today we are going to be wrapping up the Gospel according to St. John.
Indeed we are. And when we wrap up the Gospel according to St. John, we will be wrapping up our time in all the Gospels. Dan, it's kind of hard to believe that we are already there. I mean, the truth is, folks, we're going to be spending a lot of time in the near future in the back of the book.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be covering a lot of those general epistles.
Yep.
We're going to be, I think we've got one more letter of Paul.
Uh-huh.
One more. And then, yeah, those general epistles. And then, of course, eventually we'll get to Revelation.
Oh, that's the one. That's the one everyone's been holding out.
That's the one, dude. That's the one. I can't wait. I mean, I'm excited to get to Revelation.
Yeah. Woo. Well, there we go. There we go.
Yeah.
Well, we can't get there yet. We got to go to this 21st chapter of John and wrap this up. We won't tell you where we are headed next. You know where we're not headed next based on what we've done before, but we're headed somewhere next. We'll let you know.
You it's going to be somewhere in the New Testament.
It is.
We can assure you of that.
It is. So let's see how John concludes this thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, we're in the midst of the resurrection account that is going on and the various appearances that Jesus has made. We've just gotten done seeing Jesus appear to Thomas in that very dramatic moment where Thomas bows down before the risen Lord and exclaims, "My Lord and my God," in praise to Jesus. And then at the end of the chapter, of course, John very famously says in chapter 20, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book," which we didn't cover last time very in depth, but it just is a good thing to note that John tells us there's a lot of things that happen in the ministry of Jesus that the gospel writers don't write down, which tells us on the one hand, the gospel writers had to be selective. They were actually telling us a story. They were giving us a narrative. And yet at the same time, it also tells us that God didn't see fit to tell us every detail of Jesus's life, which, might go some way towards explaining why we don't know more about, say, the childhood of Jesus. Only Luke has really anything about what happens in those years from basically his birth to 18 years old. We don't know much about that. But why? Because they weren't seen as being essential to what we need to know for our salvation. That's the whole point.
Yep.
So he says, "These are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Now we head to the last chapter. It says in verse 1 of chapter 21, "After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together." So the majority of the disciples are hanging out together. And it says, "Simon Peter said to them, 'I am going fishing.' They said to him, 'We will go with you.' They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing." Now, Dan, some have surmised that maybe the reason that Peter is deciding to go fishing is that Peter is looking to change his career, that he's going to go from being the chief apostle in the group to taking back up his old fishing business. That could be.
Yeah.
But it could be just as likely that, Peter still goes fishing.
Yeah, I mean, they got to eat. I mean, this is the way that this guy is really good at providing food for himself in this particular way.
That's right. It could be something just as simple. And so sometimes people have speculated that this is Peter sort of giving up on the ministry that was laid out for him. And based on the context, maybe there's some truth to that. Whatever the case may be, Peter is not in a place where he is contented with his status. Even though he's seen the risen Lord, we don't get the sense that Peter knows exactly where he's going to be based on the fact that he's denied Jesus three times before Jesus was crucified. So it says, just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, verse 4, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? They answered him, no. He said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. Now, I think this is important to note, Dan. There is much similarity between this encounter with Jesus and Peter's first encounter with Jesus.
Yeah.
If we go back to the very beginning of the calling of Peter, we know that the very similar thing happened, very same thing, where they hadn't caught any fish. They were ready to probably throw in the towel. Jesus says, cast on the other side of the boat, and they bring in a haul of fish that they cannot bring up. Same thing happening here. That is not an accident. Jesus is alluding to what he's going to do with Peter, just as he called him the first time. There's going to be a sort of recalling, as it were.
Yeah, and you have other accounts of this where Peter like protests a little bit, so you get like vintage Peter, you know, where he says, cast that net on the other side, and he's like, look, man, we've been out here. I know how to fish, dude. Like, oh, just throw it on the other side of the boat, huh? That'll fix it, right? Like, do you really think that Peter's only cast a net in one spot the whole time? They've been out there all night.
Yeah.
That's
the reality. I mean, just as Peter didn't know who he was dealing with at that time, at the beginning, he doesn't know who he's dealing with here yet either. He doesn't recognize that it's Jesus. Nevertheless, that disciple whom Jesus loved, which we are speculating is John, therefore said to Peter, it is the Lord. Now, why did he recognize it is the Lord? Because they brought in the same haul of fish, the same massive haul of fish that they did at the beginning of their interaction with Jesus. Mm-hmm. He sees the similarity. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. Again, notes of familiarity here, just like the time that Jesus was walking on the water and Peter boldly goes out and walks on the water to Jesus, so too Peter is willing to throw himself out onto the sea to be with Jesus. Verse 8, the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. So when they got out on the land, verse 9, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Now, Dan, is there any significance here to the fact that John points out that they had caught 153 fish?
I don't think so.
Okay, give your explanation as to why and tell us what some have speculated the 153 might mean.
I don't even know. Like, is there a speculation on this? You must have heard something I've not heard. I think I've heard people try to make a big deal out of the net not being torn and the number is given of exactly 153.
Some have speculated that this was the number of nations known at the time in the world, 153 nations. And so the net not being torn is representing catching all the nations. I'm with you, though, Dan, on this particular piece of speculation.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, maybe. That's fine. Like, no, I mean, that's sort of like a no harm, no foul kind of interpretation. Like, okay, that's fine. I think that is not spelled out real clearly here, but that he's just telling you how many. I mean, I'll give you this. Like, 153 is an interesting number. I mean, when Jesus does other things, we don't have numbers that exact. It's 5,000, 4,000, you know?
Yes.
It's nice round numbers. If it just said 150, you would assume that it's an estimate. This
yes.
is pretty specific, so there's that difference in it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with 153 of them representing, you know, the known nations at the time is there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of evidence one way or another that there was only 153 known nations at the time. It's just, that's the truth. Like, I mean, as cool as it might be to think that that's what it means, we just don't, we don't really know where that speculation came from. That's just the reality. So unless we have good reason to believe such a thing actually existed, it's better for us not to add to what the scriptures say.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where this interpretation, if you think that's what it is, it's not going to really take you anywhere bad. You know, yeah. This isn't an interpretation that would like touch on any other doctrines and like lead you down some heretical road. It's like, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the best what we can say. Maybe. Yeah. So Jesus said to them, verse 12, come and have breakfast. Now, none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them. And so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So Jesus prepared a little breakfast for them, a little fish, a little bread, and is communing with them, or is having a moment of communion with them, not in the sense of the Lord's table, but a moment of fellowship with them in his risen body. And the key thing here that we will see is that Jesus actually eats the fish.
Yeah.
So the fact that Jesus in his resurrected body is nevertheless still able to eat is one of the things that Jesus will do for the disciples to show them that he really is who he says he is.
Yeah, and that he has a physical body. This isn't some kind of just spiritual manifestation. Before they got in the boat, they didn't all, you know, eat some shrooms and then fish all night and then see a vision or whatever. That this is a real person who cooked breakfast and eats it with them.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is that's the point, is that Jesus wants to show them that he does have a physical body. It's different. It's a different body. It's a body that somehow or another is able to like just appear in rooms, somehow doesn't have a problem with doors, but it is a physical body.
I'm not sure that Jesus' physical body ever had a problem with that stuff. I hear people make that argument a lot, like the sort of resurrected body that Jesus has and like, oh, it's like walking through locked doors and stuff. I'm like, yeah, well, that body that he had before the resurrection was walking on water and vanishing through crowds. So I think what you're talking about here is the old communication of attributes, which is Jesus is fully man, but he is fully God, and he always was fully God. His body is in all ways like your body in the sense that he has a physical body, and there's nothing that you have that he doesn't have. However, he does have things that you don't have because you don't have full divinity, and there is a communication of the divinity of the divine to the human or to the physical that makes him be able to do things with his body that you can't do with your body. And so, you know, I think that
it makes him be able to do works that we can't do with our bodies. I mean, it's not just the walking on water, but it's also like touching people and bringing them back to life.
Yeah, when we say he's fully man, we mean that everything that my body is, his body is. It's not lacking anything that I have. But correct. I don't possess any divinity, and he is fully divine.
Yes, correct.
So it is different in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we pick it up at verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, which is really, you get the sense that this is the main purpose of the breakfast, is that Jesus wants to have some alone time with Peter. Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?
Now, this is important right here. I had someone ask me recently what I thought Jesus was referring to when he said these.
It's a very important question.
This person was wondering if I thought he meant the fish. Like, do you love me more than this huge catch?
Yes.
I don't think so. I think he's talking about the other disciples. However, either way, it is possible that he means that this fish, like this incredible haul. Do you love me more than the thing, this miracle that just happened? Either way, what he's doing is he's asking him, do you love me more than everything else?
Yeah, that's the point. That's the point is, do you love me more than everything else? Am I number one, mm-hmm. so to speak? And Peter, of course, very characteristically says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs.
This is one of the reasons that I think he's talking about the disciples, because Peter is going to be sort of the head of the church, not in a pope sense, but he is the leader of the church in Jerusalem. As most people believe, the eldest of the apostles. He's the one that Jesus says very leadership-like things to. He's definitely part of that inner circle of Peter, James, and John. And it does seem that this is, you know, Peter's going to be sort of the guy, even though he has like radically fallen in his denial of Jesus. And it seems that he's saying, hey, do you love me more than these? And he says, yes. And then Jesus turns it and says, great, take care of these.
Yes, that's right. And it is an interesting thing. I mean, when he says to him, feed my lambs, you know, you could translate that word tend my lambs. It's the idea is like take care of my lambs. Mm-hmm. But it is also in Greek, it's this active imperative verb. And so it carries with it this like this idea of keep on, continually feed my lambs. Like this is what I want you to do going forward. Now, this is very significant because, of course, Peter has every reason to believe that he's disqualified himself from doing such a thing.
Sure, yeah.
He's denied him three times at his moment of greatest need, moment of greatest trial. You've got to believe that Peter feels like he's entirely unworthy to do anything with the lambs.
Well, of course he is.
Of course he is.
Yeah.
And yet Jesus does the quickest reinstatement into pastoral ministry that's ever happened in the history of the universe. I mean, we're talking a matter of a few days. And he's like, nope, I know you just denied me three times. You lied about knowing me. You even brought down curses on yourself to show these people that you didn't know me. You did an evil thing. I want you to be the leader of my church.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and this is why this is going to be so shocking. Of course, Jesus is not going to ask him this question one time.
No. As a matter of fact, and there's a reason for that as well. And so again, we pick it up in the narrative. Jesus again says, "Okay, since I've told you to tend my sheep," he said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." Again, same command. He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep."
Yeah, so he gets Peter to state his love for Christ three times to mirror these three denials, and this is why he was grieved that he asked him a third time. But Jesus is not attempting to grieve him here, but this is his way of saying, "I of course know what you did." And Peter alludes to this. He says, "You know everything." This is true. And what Jesus is doing is saying, I'm going to give you this command that pertains to feeding my sheep the same amount of times that you deny me, to just let you know that I know that and that I'm still doing this, I'm still giving this to you.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. I mean, the three questions to Peter, all the same question, really do, they are meant to bring up in our mind the three denials of Peter. And it's as if this is the means by which he's reinstating Peter by reversing that, mm-hmm. so to speak. And it is, of course, something that's of note that the first two times Jesus asks Peter if he loves him, he does use the word agape, And Peter responds in both those times, I phileo you, which is a friendly type of, it's a the brotherly love that one would have. But then the third time when Jesus asks him if Peter loves him, Jesus uses the word phileo and Peter responds with phileo. And so there is this sense, you could interpret this as Jesus sort of coming down to Peter's level, so to speak, as he asks Peter if he loves him. There is also, though, some scholars that will point out that it wouldn't have been unusual to use these words interchangeably and that we ought not read too much into that. And I'm prone to thinking that we ought not read too much into it as well. I think sometimes teachers and preachers can make a lot of hay out of this,
yeah,
and we're not really meant to make a whole lot of hay over this. The important part is the reinstatement of Peter with the three affirmations of his loyalty to Jesus rather than the three denials.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's Jesus really and Jesus' response this third time is not just feed my sheep, he goes on.
That's right. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me.
Yeah.
There's a lot packed in here, Dan. Go ahead.
There's a lot there. So this is, you know, hey, when you were young, and this is especially true, Peter's an impetuous, bold, does what he wants kind of guy, right? I mean, we get that feeling from Peter. He's like, yeah, that's how you used to be, but the time is coming where someone's going to stretch out your arms and they're going to take you to a place that you don't want to go. And you know, John says this is to show what kind of death he was going to die, which is Peter is crucified in Rome upside down.
That's right.
And you might say that this after this saying, follow me, I think there's two things going on there. One, it's the same thing that he said from the beginning to Peter. You know, like he said to all the disciples, follow me. And he's telling him to keep doing that. So he's called Peter again, as it were, and now he's using the same word, follow me. I think this is also ties into telling Peter, hey, something's going to happen to you. Follow me all the way to the cross, which is where Peter is ultimately going.
Yeah. Trust me all the way to the place that you would not want to go, naturally. But, and indeed, based on what we have from historical accounts, Peter does go willfully. Mm-hmm. Peter goes and chooses to be crucified upside down, at least from the accounts we have, because he doesn't believe he's worthy to be crucified in the same manner that Jesus is crucified.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this, too, is that, you know, Peter goes from guy who denies Christ three times to guy who willingly is crucified. I mean, Peter is afraid and denies Christ because Jesus is simply on trial and people are screaming out to crucify him. And this is making Peter very nervous. Peter will eventually willingly go to be crucified.
That's right. That's right.
It's weird. It's weird how the grace of God, like what that does to somebody. Like Peter gets a little forgiveness, and all of a sudden things are a little bit different for him.
Yeah, well, what I mean, the whole account we're just reading is Peter being reassured that he's forgiven of his sin.
Yeah, that's right.
This is a great narrative about absolution. Mm-hmm. This is a great narrative, not just about absolution, but about the fact that God can use even fallen Christians, Christians that have blown up their life, and still use them in powerful ways. He can absolve them. And then he can empower them. And that's exactly what he does to Peter. That's exactly what he does to Peter. So I don't know, you know, who's listening to this particular episode. But Dan, I know for a fact that someone is listening out there that has blown up their life in some way or another.
Yeah.
And you just need to know that that's not the end. That you just need to know that the word of forgiveness is for you and that God still can and will work through you, just as he did with Peter.
Yeah, and not that you're going to do something incredible or amazing, you're going to be like Peter, but I think the important thing is that we all have those moments where we have turned our back on God, and this is not true of God. That God does not turn his back to us and calls us back and forgives us. And if nothing else, you get the assurance that you are loved and forgiven by God, and that God can still do some things through you and will do some things. He might do great things. He might do small things. He uses redeemed vessels. It's the only kind of vessel he uses.
And the fact is, the vast majority of the time, I dare say all the time, the things that you have done that may have made you feel like you've ruined everything oftentimes are turned around by God to be used for the rest of your life in ways that impact people profoundly. Having gone through the pain or through the suffering, or whether you inflicted it or whether it was inflicted upon you, whatever it is, God has seen fit to use those things in a redemptive way to bring the gospel to others.
Yep.
It happens all the time. And so we get to the very end of the chapter. It says in verse 20, Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also had leaned back against him during the supper and had said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? I love the fact that Peter's like, okay, I'm picking up what you're laying down here about my future. It doesn't sound particularly pleasant. So what about old John over there?
Yeah.
I want to know what his fate is.
Yeah, I and you might be like, oh, what's Peter doing here? I think that Peter is wondering, hey, am I the only one that has to have a fate like that? Maybe even he's thinking, like, is that my punishment for denying, like, what about this guy? All right, what about him? I don't think it's a, well, if it's me, then it better be him too. But I think that Peter wants to know, like, is this how it's going to go for all of us, or is this just a me thing?
Yeah, yeah. And Jesus says to him, verse 22, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Don't worry about anybody else.
That's right.
You just follow me.
And that seems like it's going to be pretty good. That's good enough for mm-hmm. Peter.
Yeah, there's no protest. So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that the disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?
Yeah, it's good that John makes this clear. So of course these Christians, these disciples are just like they are now. Jesus says this, hey, if it's my will that he not die until I come, what is that to you? And they're like, he's not going to die. Unbelievable. Like, Jesus is coming back and John's going to be alive
to see
it. We've
got a second Enoch here.
Yes. And and of course, John's like, that's not what he said.
Yes.
Now, take this.
And
take
John
this
is
little...
probably writing this letter, writing this gospel towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
John probably is aware that, like, death is coming.
There's a lot of times when you're reading the Bible, you need to stop, read it again, and be like, oh, wait, that's not what he said.
Yes, that is correct. And it's good to know that that happened in the early church, too. Like, yes. oh, yeah, we got that wrong. This is the disciple who was bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Now, there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. End of gospel.
Yeah. So here you have John say, hey, that whole disciple that Jesus loved, the whole disciple leaning against Jesus, that's the one who's writing the book. That's the one who is penning this. And then, yeah, you got to love this this really poetic ending. You know, John starts the gospel, you know, his gospel very poetically. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And ends with this, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books if all that Jesus did was to be written down.
Yeah.
So you don't think it's not just that Jesus did some other things. It seems that John says he did a lot more than what is written here.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, you have 33 years of life and you have a very select few moments throughout his life and ministry that are actually reported for us.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going around daily ministering to hundreds and hundreds of people on a regular basis. Yeah, I mean, it would be a lot of information. And yet, the information that's written for us is there for one purpose, to show us why we need Jesus to be saved, and it is sufficient.
That's right. Amen. And that is it, man. We are out of time. We'll leave it right there. That is the gospel according to John. We will be back next week with a new episode and a new book. So make sure that you don't miss that. Make sure you jump on the first chapter of whatever it is that we're going to be going through. Eric, I will see you then.
Sounds good.